everybody. My name is Scott Traynor, and I am an alcoholic. Can we start with the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. You know, I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the people. I really do. And I got to start off and tell you it hasn't always been like that. You know, I'd like to welcome the newcomers that are here and let you know that you're never going to have a better sobriety date than the one you got, so you might as well keep it. You're never going to have the best story in AA, so you might as well keep that one, too. You know, it's a privilege and an honor to be here and to be introduced by... How's that? All right, I'll lean in. It's a privilege and an honor to be here and to be introduced by Don. You know, I've been receiving a lot of ribbing in the last day from people from California and from Cleveland because I now realize that I am in the mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I don't have to give you guys a history lesson on Alcoholics Anonymous because this is where it all started. And we learned to share our experience, strength, and hope and talk a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and that's what I'm going to try to do today. I live in New York now. My home group is the Fireside Group in Poland, New York, where they believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of action that's outlined in it. They believe in sponsorship, and they believe in the tradition. Now, they didn't really know that till I got there last month, but I came from a group called the High Desert Big Book Group in Palmdale, California, where those are the things that we believe in and that we're taught. You know, and I'm going to start a little bit. I was born and raised in New England. I was born and raised in Boston. I grew up in the projects. I know what it's like to stand in line and get blocks of cheese and powdered milk and get hand-me-downs and get taken out by the Salvation Army for Christmas presents and stuff like that. You know, our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the alcoholic being like a tornado roaring through the lives of others, and my dad was that alcoholic. Now, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I just knew I didn't like my dad, and I didn't like the police always at my house. You know, I joke sometimes and talk about my family reunions being like the Jerry Springer Show. That's really what it was like. You never knew. I had several uncles that were police officers, and you never knew when they were coming to take my dad out and the insanity of it. You know, our book talks about the selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, self-pitying character traits that we have driven by those 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. And I believe I had a lot of those character traits before I picked up my first drink. My story is not the story of drinking out of a brown paper bag at the age of 5, but I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood where drinking was predominant, and I drank whenever and, you know, how often I could. The drinking age was 18, and I would steal beers from my dad. And, you know, Dr. Silkworth talks about the sense of ease and comfort which comes from taking a few drinks. And, you know, you hear people that speak talk about their pimples falling off and they grew 6 feet and they could talk to girls and all that. That's really not my experience. My experience was I could just breathe. You know what I mean? I was in a world I didn't belong, and I all this insanity that was going around me, I had a definite problem with authority. You know, the big book talks about defiance as being one of our chief character traits, and I was very defiant. I don't care if it was a teacher, a policeman, you know, babysitter. If you tried to tell Scotty what to do, I rebelled against it, and consequently it caused me a lot of heartache. You know, I started going to a program called Al-Anon with my mother. And do we have any Al-Anons here today? Yeah. You? All right. We're still going to try to have fun, but no, I'm just kidding. I love the program of Al-Anon. I really do. You know, but at the time when I was going in New England, this is back in 1970 and stuff, you know, when I was going to Al-Anon, there were no men in Al-Anon. They were all women, and would meet at Sacred Heart Church in the basement. And to me, they were just a bunch of cackling old hens who sat around the table and complained about their husbands and the way they were being treated. I didn't get anything out of Al-Anon. You know, my dad was the type that would follow us to these meetings and sit in a van down the street drinking, and then follow us home and beat my mom up and call her a whore, and who was she meeting there, because he knew that she was meeting somebody there, and she wasn't meeting anybody there. She was just trying to find a better way for her boys through the program of Al-Anon. You know, the big book talks about the warped lives of blameless children and wives and parents and stuff, and this is a family disease. And I didn't know that at that time. You know, I didn't understand what this terrible, terrible disease of alcoholism was. And I started going to Alateen, and I'd take the trains into South Boston. And Alateen was the program for children of alcoholics where we learn about the disease. And bottom line is I didn't get anything out of Alateen because I didn't want anything out of Alateen. You know, Alateen was a place for me to go and manipulate and get you to feel sorry for me and the way I was being raised. You know, around this time in 1972, I had my first arrest. It was for assault and battery on a police officer and drunken disorderly conduct. And I got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. And I was 12 years old, just turning 13, and I walked into the young people's group. It was a Quincy Bay group in Quincy, Massachusetts on Hancock Street. And I walked in there, and the youngest young person in the room was like 30. You know, and they talked about losing cars and homes and families and going to jails and stuff. And I didn't even have a driver's license, you know, and I'm sitting there trying to relate to these people. And how they used to do it, I talk a lot about customs around the United States because there's different customs no matter where you go in Alcoholics Anonymous. The basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous is the same, but you have different customs all over the country. And how they used to do it back then, 32 years ago, was they would interview you to basically find out whether you were a real alcoholic and whether you belong there. And some of the old-timers after that meeting cornered me and started interviewing me. And when I say old-timers, I'm talking about the guys with 90 days and 6 months, you know, and they started talking to me. And you hear all the cliches in AA, oh, you got a watch, you can't be an alcoholic, oh, you got a car, oh, you're not done, you haven't hit your bottom, stuff like that. And they sat me down and they basically precluded me from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they said that I was too young, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, you know, I've spilled more than you could have drank, all those cliches. And you know, chapter 3, more about alcoholism, talks about through every form of the self-deception, the experimentation, we try to prove ourselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. And I kept going out there defending my right to drink, okay? You know, and I was ordered from the court, so I had to go to these meetings. And they had the customs of 90 days. You couldn't share unless you had 90 days, and they had commitments, and you went to different groups, and you put on their meeting, but you couldn't share unless you had 90 days. And I had a lot of good stuff to share, but I could never get 90 days. You know, I was 13 years old, and I could never get this 90-day thing. And I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, that vicious cycle, you know, and I started having a lot of problems, and I ran away from home, and I was on Skid Row. I had my first detox when I was 14, and I was on Skid Row at 16 in the Pine Street Inn in Boston, eating out of dumpsters and trash cans, and in and out of the homes of the bewildered, as my friend Jim Buckley talks about, you know, getting strapped to beds, getting pumped with lithium, Thorazine, chloral hydrate, Haldol, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they didn't really talk about the big book then. It was more meetings, meetings, meetings. And you'd hear things like, you got to get a sponsor. You know, you need to get a sponsor. And I was 16 years old, and I was always told to sit in the front row, and you find someone that you identify with. And I don't know how they do it in Cleveland, but I know back then you had anniversaries, okay? And let's say Lou was my sponsor and I was celebrating an anniversary today. Lou would get up as my sponsor and tell you, the group, everything I've done in the last year of my sobriety. The community involvement, right? Really, the community involvement, the things that I have done in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I would get up and I would say a few words and basically sit down. And this guy, I'll never forget it was like yesterday, this guy, Fred, was taking a 4-year anniversary medallion, and his sponsor got up and said all this wonderful stuff about Fred. And then Fred got up, and he stood here at the podium, and he pulled out that medallion, and he says, you know, he goes, I was really nervous this morning when I woke up because I knew I was going to have to get up here in front of all you people. So I smoked a joint to take the edge off, okay? And he went on, and when he was done, you know, everybody clapped, and I got to tell you, I loved what he had to say. So the meeting got over, and I went right up to Fred and asked him to be my sponsor. And that was my first experience with sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Now, years later, I'll jump ahead, but years later, make no mistake, see, back then you did not talk about drugs from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at many a meeting where people would literally get pulled from the podium if they started talking about drugs. And I had a lot of misconceptions on what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was, what this spiritual answer was, what this common solution was, okay? Because I'm sitting there as a young kid looking at these role models thinking it's okay to smoke weed. You know, luckily Dr. Silkworth and the doctor's opinion closes all those loopholes when he talks about we can't take alcohol in any form. Okay, and that the only treatment we have to offer really is entire abstinence. But I didn't know that at the time because I never read the book. See what I mean? I just go to meetings and I would take direction from a lot of parrots in Alcoholics Anonymous. And y'all know what I'm talking about when people get up here and they just talk out the sides of their neck like they know what's going on because they hear something good at this meeting, and so they try to use it as their own, when really that's not what the program that's outlined in the big book is all about. And I had never read the big book or anything, so I was on this vicious cycle. You know, they had diagnosed me as suicidal, homicidal, and manic depressive, and I loved it years later when I read the book, when it lists the different types of alcoholics, it says, and then we have the manic depressive type, which is probably the least understood amongst us. of which a whole chapter could be written. And then they didn't write the chapter. That was my chapter, God. But I'm on this vicious cycle, and I start going into all these DYS, Division of Youth Service Board. You know, it's like a YA youth authority type thing, and I was in the Scared Straight program going into Walpole State Prison and Billerica and all these things, and, you know, these convicts would corner you and try to get your shoes from you and tell you that what they're going to do to you if you come in there, and, you know, my heroes Hacksaw and Shotgun, who shot his father-in-law and all this stuff, and it was a game to me because, you know, I always felt that if you just left me alone, I would be okay. If you just leave me alone, one day I'm going to be a millionaire, and one day I'm going to do this, and one day I'm going to do that, if you just leave me alone. Because I was in a world I didn't belong, you know, and I got around the system and started smuggling dope into these guys in the Scare Straight program and stuff. It was all a joke to me. It was all a game, you know. And then I started going into the drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs, the type that shaved your head and made you wear dunce caps and sit on the bench and stuff and, you know, try to give you, when you left, those $20,000 big books, you know, because sending you to AA and just in and out, in and out. It was a vicious cycle. You know, I got a girl pregnant and decided to do the responsible thing and settle down. She came from a rich Irish Catholic family. I came from a poor one, and we got married, and 2 weeks later she was back home with her family, and I was off and running. I had never really stopped, you know. It's the delusion that we have, and this is a disease of perception, and we are good at telling our loved ones, our family, our wives, our kids, you know, that this time's different. This time I mean it, you know. And there were a lot of times that I meant it, you know, but I just couldn't stop. I didn't understand that this was a disease that affected me spiritually, physically, and emotionally, and that it was the allergy of my body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And when I drank, I was trying to overcome that obsession that I had no control over, and I had lost the power of choice to drink. But you couldn't tell me that, okay? You just really couldn't tell me that because of all the examples that I had had. And, you know, I found myself in the combat zone in Boston. It's a red light district. It was a red light district back in the 70s. And a few of my friends and us, we started rolling prostitutes. And if you don't know what that is, it's robbing them. And I had my first arrest as an adult for armed robbery. And I walked into that Charles Street jail, which is the oldest jail in New England, and it's 5 tiers, and I walked in there like that Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder movie, Stir Crazy, you know? That's right, We Bad, and I walked in there, and this guy got thrown off the 5th tier, and he got killed, and it scared me to death, you know? I was facing 8 to 10 years in Walpole State Prison, and I was at that depths of despair, that jumping off point that the Big Book talks about, you know, where we can't picture life with alcohol or without, and I had been trying different things through psychiatry, through psychologists and Alcoholics Anonymous and church and, you know, all these things. And my God was a condemning God who sat on that throne and wrote down all the bad things that I had done, you know. And I had done a lot of bad things, you know. I really had. And I'm thinking about my life and that self-absorption. I'm on me, you know. I'm just on me. And I can't get me off of me. And the suicidal thoughts came in. And the book talks about that there will be those of us that choose to make the supreme sacrifice and to continue the fight. And I was in this jail for 3 days, and I got bailed out. Massachusetts is a commonwealth law state. I don't know what Ohio is. But basically how it works there is you have the right to face your accuser. If your accuser doesn't show up, they dismiss it, lack of prosecution. And so I was facing all these years. I got out, and I decided to kill myself, and I went home, and I got drunk, and I rolled myself a half a dozen joints. And being a good Irish Catholic kid, I wanted an open casket. You know, I wanted the wake, and I wanted people to come and feel sorry for Scotty, and he was such a good kid. And I climbed in this bathtub, and I six-pack of beer, and I sliced my wrist. And I did it the right way. I got 110 stitches in each arm. I shredded them all the way up, and I bled all night as I was drinking that six-pack of Schlitztals. And that's how they found me the next morning. And 5 days later, when I came out of it on the critical list, when his doctor, Robert DiTullio, had pieced everything together, he had ruled that from me drinking that beer throughout the night, I had replenished my body with the liquid and the barley and the hops, and that had saved my life, okay? So I'm an alcoholic that can honestly tell you that alcohol saved my life, right? You know, a peculiar twist, right? Perception of reality there. And, you know, I found myself in another home to the bewildered, Medfield State Hospital, strapped to a bed. I ended up beating that case, lack of prosecution. It's pretty hard to find street people. Then there was another suicide attempt in there. I was back in the psych ward, and this woman came to see me. And she told me about this guy named Jesus Christ, that if I accepted him as my personal savior, that behold, everything would be new. You know, and she started talking about this loving, caring God. And I had tried just about everything that I had thought. But I had never gone this route, and I figured, well, this is a little different twist. I might as well try this. And so I went to this program called Teen Challenge. And I quit smoking, swearing, watching TV, listening to rock and roll. You know, alcoholics of my type go from one extreme to the next. And I started going to Bible study 5 hours a day, church 7 days a week. I entered the ministry. I was going to become a preacher. Started traveling to New England, giving my testimony how Christ had saved my life. I'd come into rooms like this with the born-again Christians. And I was that square peg just trying to fit in that round hole. And they had something in the eyes. You know, there was something there that I wanted. But I just didn't fit. And I would come into these rooms and they'd be talking in tongues and passing out. And, you know, we're good actors. Our book talks about how we're actors. And I figured, well, I need to fit in here and I need to get filled with this spirit. So I would try to pass out. And so I would stand there and I would fall back and I'd hurt my head. And I figured, well, these people aren't getting hurt. I'm getting hurt here. I better not do that. So I would stand there and I'd say, okay, well, I'll try this here. And I would start talking in tongues, you know, making this stuff up in my head. And old Don over here in the corner would start interpreting what the Spirit was telling him that I was saying. And so I knew he was lying and he was a hypocrite because I was making it up, right? This throne of judgment that I talk about sometimes, I was sitting on this throne of judgment. And basically, the way the steps are worked out and the way the big book is worked out from the doctor's opinion through page 63 deal with two things, and they're conclusions of the mind. You know, the first step talks about we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. That was the easiest step for me because I could admit it to the judge, I could admit it to my mom or whoever. But see, the second part to that step talks about conceding to the innermost self, and that I had never done. Okay. At this time in my life, we're getting up to 1978 now, you know, I had, through my track record, okay, I had come to believe that my life was unmanageable and that alcohol, King Alcohol, had me. Unmanageability simply means not achieving one's purpose, you know, and I knew I wasn't achieving my purpose. And the second step talked about came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You know, there's a funny story that Father Ed Dowling used to talk about, Cleveland, as a matter of fact, that there were a lot of Catholics, and when Clarence had started the first AA meeting up here, that they had a problem with Catholics with the steps, because when they would be approached sitting on the bar about taking these steps, the first step was no problem, but the second step where the Catholic would sit on the bar and say, came to believe, I already believe, I don't have to do any caming, you know, and in a great burst of love and kindness, they continued to drink to try to let the Protestants catch up. I loved that when I heard that, right? Because I did a lot of caning too. And I'm in this program, and the way the big book works is the first two steps are nothing but conclusions of the mind. That's all they are. They're not workable. They're conclusions of the mind. And I had concluded in my mind that I was an alcoholic. I had come to believe in this power greater than myself that he could restore me to the sanity. You know, step three talks about making the decision to turn our will and our lives, which is nothing more but our thoughts and our actions, over to this care of God. And I had made this decision. I had done this, and I believed, okay? What I had never done, though, is that fearless and thorough moral inventory of myself, let alone admit it to God, to ourselves, and another human being. You know, when I said I had done a lot of bad things, I had done a lot of bad things. And I like it in AA when people come in here, and I don't know about you. You know, I did a lot of bad things. And people come into AA and they're sensitive. I'm a sensitive alcoholic, you know. And the book does say that. The book does say that the alcoholic is sensitive, but the very next sentence says that it takes some of us a long time to overcome this serious handicap. It's a handicap. It's not an asset, you know. And they come in here and they say, oh, don't say anything. It's going to hurt my feelings because I'll drink. You know. If I'm honest about it, I was as sensitive as a rhinoceros when I was drinking. You know, when I drank and I was out there, I would burglarize your house, I would rob you, stick a gun in your face and take your money, I would screw your wife. I would do whatever I had to do to drink. And then I come into AA and I say, oh, please don't say anything that'll hurt my feelings. I might drink, okay? That's a crock, you know? But I'm in this program, and my first three steps I had pretty much done. And then in the fourth step, I went to this director. See, I woke up one morning a few months into this program, and I was still dark and dirty on the inside. And what was inside me was like eating me, like gangrene. If I didn't get it out, it was going to kill me. You know, I went to this director of the program, and see, I believe that it's like this cup of coffee. If you took it and put it underneath the sink over there and drip nice, cool, clear liquid into it and come back an hour from now, it's still going to be dark and dirty on the inside. See, and that's what I was. I was dark and dirty. The way the fourth and fifth step of work is to dump this, okay, so that I can take that good, clear liquid in and that the spirit in and be filled, okay? And I didn't know this at the time, and I went to the director and I told him I needed to get this stuff out. He didn't think I needed to get it out because I had faced all conditions through the power of Christ Jesus. I was forgiven. We started quoting scripture back and forth. The defiance came back. I told him what he could do with this program, and I walked away from it. You know, and I went back into the same acquaintances, the same friends in the projects with the firm conviction that I wasn't going to drink. I'm just not going to drink, okay? I'm just going to smoke a little pot. Because I had a misconception, I remember back then, I had a misconception of what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Even my father in AA did Darbon and Librium and all this other stuff, and I had a lot of misconceptions. So I still thought in my mind it was okay to smoke pot. And I had heard a saying way back in 1972 that the man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes the man. You know, and I would be coming into meetings and stuff and smoking that pot, and it was just a matter of time before I had that cotton mouth and I picked up a drink. Big Book refers to as we can't bring to sufficient force the pain, the misery of a week or a month ago, and we succumb as so many of us do one more time through that delusion. You know, and I found myself off and running one more time. On November 14, 1979, I found myself at the depths of despair one more time, sitting up on this bridge called the Bourne Bridge in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, 169 feet up. And it was a big drama. You know, the state police had blocked the bridge off, and the Corps of Engineers and Coast Guard were down in the canal with spotlights on me, and the Good Samaritan Suicide Prevention League were there talking to me on bullhorns. And, you know, the SWAT teams, every time they got close, I'd say, "Don't do it, I'll jump. And, you know, they'd back away. And, you know, underneath is this campground called the Bourne Scenic Park, and all the campers came out, and they set up lawn chairs, and they're all down there. They did. And they're all down there partying and stuff, yelling at me, "Jump, you motherfucker, jump!" And I'm up there, I'm looking down at these people going, "Oh my God, these people are crazy. You know, don't they know if I jump, I'm going to die?" This is the thoughts that I'm running in. See, and I'm sitting up there thinking, you know, they talk about resentment being the number one offender, okay? And I'm replaying the Latin word. I'm replaying all my life stuff in my brain sitting up on this bridge. I was up there 4.5 hours. And I'm replaying all this stuff. And I'm thinking of all the terrible things in my life and all, you know, all the bad things. I'm not thinking about being a Boy Scout and being trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, right? I'm not thinking about saving a kid's life when I was 10 years old and getting honored by the House of Representatives in a plaque, okay? I'm thinking about my father being drunk and not showing up and me standing on the stage all alone. You know, I'm up there thinking about coming home from school one day and having my dad escort me to my room, and there was a lock on the outside of the door, and I knew there was a problem. And he handed me a milk jug with the top cut off and put me in the room, and it was so dark I couldn't see. And I find the light and turn it on, and my whole window had been sheet metaled and riveted. And he would let me out in the morning to go to school and lock me in at night. I'm thinking these things, you know. And now, granted, I must have been a hard kid to raise, okay? You know, they call it child abuse today. Back then, that was par for the course. That was just punishment. You know, that's how we were raised. And I'm sitting up there on this bridge thinking of all this stuff with no hope, you know, feeling that flawed, ashamed, defective, unlovable, nothing works for me. And I'm thinking the delusion, you know, Dillinger and how the West was won and King Arthur's court, and I should have been a knight in King Arthur's court. And you hear people talk about that stuff, and I was really feeling those things. I was adopted, you know, I'm in a world I don't belong. And about 4.5 hours into this thing, I decided, you know what, there's got to be something out here for me. There's got to be something. And I decided to get down. You know, we call that the moment of clarity. Okay, and that's what I had. I had this moment of clarity that there's got to be something out here for me. And I stood up to get down, and then this is where another thought came into my head. And it was an honest thought, and it was a real thought. And the thought that came into my head the next thing was, you know what, Scotty? If you get down, you're going to look like a pussy to all these people that have waited all this time. You got to jump. So I turned and I jumped. You know, I don't remember hitting the water. They say I died. They say I was dead for almost 13 and a half minutes, and the only bone I broke was my sternum bone and my chest cavity, and that was from them giving me the precardial thumbs, bringing me back to life. They don't do that anymore because it can cave your chest in and kill you. You know, fast forward here real quick. A couple years ago, I my chest was really bothering me, and I developed a lump, and it was growing, and it was really bothering me, and I went to this doctor, and they did some tests, and they were going to biopsy it, and they opened it up and closed it right away, and they didn't know what it was, and I was in Boston at the time. I was in California, but I was in Boston on a vacation. They called me back to California for immediate surgery with a thoracic surgeon, cancer specialist at Kaiser, because they didn't know what it was, and it was 2.5 inches long, and it was like, you know, that wide, and it went down on my aorta and was pressing on my aorta. And so they wanted immediate surgery to take this thing out, and I flew back to California, and they performed the surgery, and when it was all done, the bottom line, what it was from back in 1979 when I jumped that bridge, and they gave me those precardial thumps. They had broken part of the bone, and it had wedged down in there and calcified and everything and almost killed me, you know. But you know how our minds go. And anyway, I found myself in another Homes of the Bewildered, you know, and strapped to the bed. I tried the Army after that. I lied about everything, and you know, the geographical cures that we hear about, no matter where I went, I took Scotty. I joined the Army out of Pennsylvania, and my six-month career in the Army, I had 4 Article 15s. I was on the Benninghaus program of alcoholism, taking Anabuse every morning in front of the CO. Anybody ever tried to drink on Anabuse? Oh, yeah, my case is different. Oh, my God. You know, and at 4 Article 15, before it was all over, I found myself in the Martin Army Hospital, strapped to the bed, getting pumped full of lithium, thorazine, chlorohydrate, and held on. You know, I talk a lot about this stuff, but see, I got to tell you, I was misdiagnosed. Okay, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about that we're outright mental defectives in full flight from reality. We're maladjusted to life, and those are some of our finer quality traits. And they diagnosed me as all these, now it's bipolar and all this stuff, but I was misdiagnosed. What I am is I'm an alcoholic, okay? I'm an alcoholic who was running, who was in search of, okay? Running from this God and yet trying to find him, and just he was nowhere. And I ended up getting out of the Army. And Chapter 5, honorable discharge, I went up to Massachusetts, decided that wasn't working for me, come to California, the land of golden opportunity, Hollywood, Beverly Hills. You know, as a young kid growing up in the projects, you hear this stuff, and there's gold in them hills, and I'm going to come to California and be discovered and be a movie star and all this stuff. And I came out to California, and on January 9th, 1981, and January 16th, I came out of a blackout. And I was sitting in L.A. County Jail. And you know, they have a saying in L.A. that you come on vacation and you leave on probation. The only problem was I wasn't leaving, and before it was all over, between L.A. County, San Bernardino County, and Riverside County, I got sentenced to 22 years sentencing in the state penitentiary in California. You know, and I was just turning 21. I was 20 years old. And I walked in there, and there were 11 institutions. This is when, for some of you old-timers, this is when Governor Brown was the governor. And under the old SP laws, and I walked into those California institutions, and those of you that have been in prison know that prison is nothing but a human kennel that breeds violence, and I let it breed the violence in me, and my attitude became, if you weren't white, you weren't right. You know, I came from Boston, one of the most racial capitals of the country in the 70s. We had forced busing. We had all these issues, these hates, these prejudices that were instilled in us from young kids, you know, growing up. And I had all these things walking into the California penitentiary, and the bottom line here is I became that absolute animal, and hurt people, got hurt myself, and just, it was insanity. And those of you that have been in prison know what I'm talking about. You know, to make a long story short, but I made it up to this institution called Tehachapi, and I got invited to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walked in, and I was sitting in the back with my back against the wall, my Bonnaroos, my bandana on. I had gotten tattoos all over my body, and I'm sitting in the back there, and they started this meeting, and they read a portion of Chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, mind you, I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 10 years at this time, but I had never heard Chapter 5. They don't do that back in Boston. They didn't do that back then. And then they read a portion of Chapter 3. It's a custom in Southern California. Portion of Chapter 3 from the Big Book, more about alcoholism. And I'm thinking, wow, this is good stuff. Where are they getting this, okay? And then this speaker got up, and his name was Eddie Miracle, and I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, wow, that's a cute name for an AA guy, Eddie Miracle, right? that really was his name. This later became my sponsor. But he got up and he started talking. And I swear he talked like a country preacher, you know. And he said, if you're new, you've come home. He said, you need never be alone again. You're like the prodigal son who had to venture out there, and now you're home. He started talking a lot about this guy named Chuck Chamberlain, and he talked about how we're all children of God. And for me to love you for your color, you not for your color, that I can't afford that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's no room for hypocrites. Either we're all God's kids or none of us are. He started talking some of these spiritual truths. You know, and they say people can't hear until they can hear, and they can't see until they can see. And for some reason, I heard and I saw. And I believe luck and chance was passing me by, and I reached up and I grabbed onto it. You know, all my life people told me what a piece of crap I was and what I couldn't do and what I couldn't become. And all of a sudden I'm sitting in a room just like this, and people just like you are telling me what I can do and what I can become if I'm willing to put forth the effort and work for it. You know, and I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous like my very life depended on it. And I started working the steps. I went back to school. I got my GED. I got 4 years of college behind me inside. And I became a gentleman, a gentle man, you know, and I started treating us all as God's kids, you know. It didn't matter. And I grew as a person, you know, and I ended up, the laws all changed. The new governor came in, Duke Magin, and everything. Those old convicts got to sign this new law, one for one. Everything got knocked off. And the bottom line is I ended up getting out, and I went to this group called the Raptors, and I went up there, and that's how I started my walk on the streets as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the dream of Alcoholics Anonymous started coming true as long as I was willing to put forth the effort and work for it, you know. And in my first 9 months, I walked to work every day. I got out with $200 gate money and a box of clothes. And I had met my wife, Kim, and this is my wife over here. She's got almost 19 years sobriety now. I had 12-stepped her into the program. We had become friends, and what had happened was I was in prison, and I'd gone for this underwater diving program, and how they do it there is there's testing out of 11 institutions, and then you go into this program, and I came second over the institutions, and before I was left to go to this program, they precluded me from it because I had broken my neck twice through drinking in my teenage years. I broke my C2 vertebrae, and they said that I couldn't handle the pressures from deep down in the water, that it would crack my neck, and so they precluded me from it, and I ended up getting my minimum B custody, and I got put on this camp crew fighting fires and stuff in the Bear Valley up in the Tehachapi Mountains. And I was up there one morning on a Monday, and this camper was in this campground, and I knew that there were a couple girls in there getting dressed. You couldn't see them, you know what I mean, but you could see the sun coming up. And so me and my friend went up there, and we were cleaning around the bathroom, and the door opened up, and who came out but this young girl with long dark hair, and she was really pretty. And you know, I said, hey, how you doing? She said, you think you can get up here any earlier? You're making a lot of noise. There was about 50 of us there. And I said, well, we'll be here all week if you'd like to leave a wake-up call, you know. And so I knew she wanted me. See? So I went back into my cell that night, and I wrote her a letter. And what I asked her basically is if she could help a poor Bostonian out, you know, that I was on this program of rigorous honesty. And I had to tell her that, you know, that I was in AA, I was on this program of honesty, and I was wondering if she would meet me over by the bathroom for a quickie. And I'd been down four years at that time, and you know, it's been a while. And I had to tell her that there was no love involved in this. It was strictly lust, okay? And so I snuck the letter there, and she came out, and I told her there was a letter in the bathroom there for her. She went and got it, and she went back in the camper and locked herself in there. In like 3.5 hours, she's in there. She would not come out of this camper. And now I'm thinking, you know, we're quick studies, some of us, you know, in AA, and I'm thinking now she's going to give the letter to the cop. They're going to arrest me because you can't have contact with free people. Now I'm going to be in the hole, all this stuff. And she came out, so I told her I was just kidding. And she laughed at me, and she said, no, you know what? She goes, I can't do something like that. You know, she goes, I really can't. So then I tried the next avenue. Well, maybe we could be friends. And we could write. And that's what we started doing. We started writing. And so now I'm out on the streets, and she's coming to meetings with me, and she gets sober. And I became a product of hospital and institution work. They call it in California H&I. I don't know what they call it here. But I got put on this pedestal of H&I, you know, I started the work, started living the dream of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to all sorts of meetings, I had my own panels in Tehachapi State Prison and Acton, and got married in Beaver, Utah. I was the speaker of Beaver, Utah, and came off the podium right into the wedding, and started traveling you know, around this country, sharing my experience, strength, and hope on how this program works, sponsored all sorts of people, started my own businesses, had an attorney service and stuff in L.A., and I mean, you know, I was making six figures, and I joined that rock and roll band that I always wanted to join, and I bought a house in Valencia, and I bought a piece of property in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and built a custom home, and I would fly between L.A. and Boston four or five times a month, getting picked up by limousines and chauffeured wherever I wanted. I mean, this program worked, you know. Coming from 20 cents an hour, okay, for years, okay, and making this and living the dream and having kids and all that other stuff, you know. See, I had done that fourth and fifth step, the sixth and seventh step, where I believe we lose a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the shortcomings, and humbly asking God to remove these. You know, it says in the sixth step, this is a step that separates the men from the boys, and it goes on with the amends process, and naturally the continuing to take the personal inventory, seeking through the prayer and meditation, and then having had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, what do? We try to carry this message, see? And what I had done, and I'm a little different speaker than you may hear, because my story is not the story of an happily ever after, okay? Because, see, our book talks about the spiritual as well as moral program. And what I had done, if you look at those steps, I had started giving those steps back one at a time. Now, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care whether you're 40 years or you're 60 days. I believe you're going towards a drink or you're going away from a drink. A book talks about there's no middle-of-the-road solution. And for a long time and a lot of years, I was going towards a drink. And I was getting up here sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you, but it was Scotty's message. It wasn't the message that we get out of the steps in this book. And that spiritual awakening was no longer there. I wasn't seeking through prayer and meditation anymore. I wasn't continuing to take personal inventory and promptly admitting when I was wrong, let alone sorry. You know, the character defects started coming back in full force. I owed a lot of people amends. But that ego and that pride and that arrogance, because it's look at me, okay? Look at me. Look at where I came from, okay? And look at where I am now, you know, and sponsoring all sorts of people. And what I did is, I got to tell you, I started practicing a program of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy, I profess the belief in a system, in a 12-step program of action that uncovers, discovers, and discards all the crap that gets me this conscious contact with God, this design for living, this joy for living, however, whichever you please, okay? And I wasn't being of maximum service to God and my fellow man. I just wasn't. They say we become as sick as our secrets, and I started having a lot of secrets, okay? You know, in the third step, it talks about in the 12 and 12 that the rest of my AA program depends upon how earnestly I do that step and continue, uses the word continue, to do that step. My thoughts and my actions, my will and my life. Okay? You know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about that the steps are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, that if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession and leave the sufferer usefully and happily whole. Well, I was no longer usefully and happily whole. And I gave them all back one at a time. And the big book says that we drink for two reasons. It's the insane thought of the trivial excuse. Talked about the insanity returning and then we drink. Make no mistake that the big book does not say we drink and then we become insane. It says the insanity returns and then we drink. And I was insane. You know, and the big book says that we have no defense against the first drink. The next sentence says, though, except in a few rare occasions. That's talking about willpower. And for a lot of years, I was going off sheer willpower, okay? Not the spiritual answer and the spiritual remedy that this program demands. And the bottom line here is I drank after long-term sobriety. And I turned my back and I walked away from Alcoholics Anonymous and I walked away from you people. You know, and I walked away from my wife and my children and the businesses. Actually, she got a better attorney if you want to know the truth. But... And I found myself in that depths of despair, that ego, that arrogance, that pride, you know, and in a real short time, I found myself renting this house, and I was down to 129 pounds, 80 pounds less than I am right now. I was shooting heroin, shooting cocaine, smoking rock cocaine, looking out the window for those Bush people because they were there, you know, and could not stop drinking, Had that spring, trying to overcome, you know, all these things. I just could not stop. I would come into AA, with 4 days or 10 days or 11 days, and I would make a decision that I just don't want to drink anymore. I just don't want to do this anymore. And I would walk out the door and get loaded anyway. Now, the Big Book talks about this as obsession, this type of thinking that when it's fully established in the alcoholic, he's probably beyond human aid, and that unless locked up, he will die or go permanently insane. It says he may die or go permanently insane. And that's where I was. You know, well-meaning, well-intentioned people would come up to me at these meetings and say, "You're done now? You got enough arrows in your ass now?" Some of the sick ones, you know, "Oh, can I be your sponsor?" Okay. Oh, that rage, that would piss me off, and I'd walk out the door and get loaded. Okay, and I would walk out and get loaded. And I just couldn't stop. I wanted to stop, and I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop. You know, Christmas night, 1996, Christmas night, one more time, I was at that jumping off point. And I took a pistol, a 25 automatic, and I shot myself in the head. Put it right here and boom. And the bullet went in the side of my head and it came out the top. And I came to 3 days later on full life support systems at the Antelope Valley Medical Center. You know, and talk about when they come out of these things that they can't even do that right. And I felt like I couldn't even do that right. You know, God, I've jumped bridges, cut my wrist, stuck my head in a gas stove, done this. I can't even shoot. God, it's going to kill me. You know? See, in death, I don't know about you as an alcoholic, death never really scared me. But you know what really scared me is living. Having to live in this pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, in the vision for you, when it talks about the hideous four horsemen of the terror, the bewilderment, the frustration, the despair, that's not when we're drinking. That's when we're trying to come out of it and get sober. Okay? And I'm feeling all this stuff one more time. And the state of California stepped in, and to make a long story short there, because I have a lot of long stories, the state of California stepped in and they pressed charges on me. And they charged me with ex-convict with a gun. It's a true story. I had 9 felony convictions back in the 80-81, and now all of a sudden I'm an ex-convict 16, 17 years later with a gun. Okay, and they charged me under the penal code with ex-felon with a gun. And I didn't know anything about this three-strike law that they have in California and stuff, and I went in and I turned myself in. And before it was all over, they remanded me into custody. I found myself sitting at Chino State Prison, and they were striking me out with 4 strikes and giving me 25 to life. Okay? Now, I had a thought, and I had another honest thought. And the thought that jumped into my head that time was, I want to be sober now. I'll work the steps. I want my wife and kids back now, right? We get spiritual real quick, I'm telling you. You know, my story is no different. And I'm sitting in there and through a letter. My relationship was so damaged with my wife. There were restraining orders against me. We could not be in the same room. We were in a bitter divorce. You know, one day she looked at me and she said, "You know, Scotty," she goes, "this relationship is so damaged, I don't even think God can fix it." And I looked at her and I said, "Well, you know, that just shows how little faith you have." And I turned around and I walked out. Now, I didn't really believe that, but it sounded good, right? Made her think. And, you know, I'm in this jail, and my wife, we're going through this divorce. She started a letter campaign for me, and people from all over the country wrote letters to this judge, Chelsea McKay, in the Lancaster Superior Court. You know, and if you've ever read the Bible and you read about Daniel in the lion's den, or you see Peter sitting in jail and the light coming and the chains falling off and he walks out a free man, that's basically my story. Because I was sitting in prison and going through all this insanity in prison. And, you know, they say we don't regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. And part of my past, I'd like to shut the door on it because I was very violent. I was very racial. And, you know, I'm in prison now again. They call me Gramps. And, they call me Gramps. And, you know, I found myself in this hole for 28 days. And I got a hold of a piece of paper and a pen because I knew how hard, with such a tremendous ego and arrogance that I pride, that I had displayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, how hard it was going to be for me to come back. to Alcoholics Anonymous, and those chips and those medallions were going to absolutely kill me. And I got hold of this piece of paper and pen, and I really looked at the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the history of it and where we came from. And I wrote this thing that when one who has wandered far into selfishness and self-centeredness seek to return to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he will encounter criticism and distrust. There will be those who whisper, he's a newcomer again. I don't think he'll make it this time either. Now, these wicked ones are doing not the work of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or of their higher power, but of their own selfish, self-centered interests. They seek to drive the returning member still farther from hope and from sobriety. You know, let the returning member contemplate the rejoicing in heaven over the return of the one that was lost. Let him in no way be disheartened by the suspicion and scorn of others. He can again walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. You see, and that's what I felt, because this program was founded off love and tolerance. Not the condemnation, the judgment we get around here sometimes, you know. It was love and tolerance. And October 7th, 1997, I'm sitting in Chino State Prison, and this Judge Chelsea McKay pulled me out of prison, and he stood me in front of him, and the gallery was full of people, mostly Alcoholics Anonymous people, family. And he's sitting there, and, you know, I've got my head shaved, and I've got that hard look one more time. And he had his bench full of papers, and he's reading them, and he's looking at me, and he's reading them, and he's looking at me. And he says, I don't understand. He says, I don't understand. You seem to have helped a lot of people in your life. You seem to have come from where you came from. He goes, I don't understand what you did to yourself. See, he didn't understand the disease of alcoholism, how we can paint this beautiful picture to our families, friends, and loved ones, employers, whatever, that this time we mean it and this time's different, just to tear the house down. Usually when you ask the alcoholic, he usually doesn't know why. He's honest about it. We often suspect we're down for the count, but we don't admit that. And he didn't understand any of that. And he looked at me and he says, I don't believe the three-strike law was intended for someone like you who shoots himself in the head. And he struck two of my strikes right there. He released me the next day on October 8th. He released me with a five-year tail. You know, with all these conditions, I had to go to a psychiatrist once a month, a psychologist once a week, AA meetings, all this stuff. They wanted to put me on all these drugs, Depakote, Depakane, Paxil, all these other drugs. And I had to sign these papers saying that I would do what they said. So I got all these pills and all this stuff, and I started hiding them in my cabinet. See, because what I had done is I had never given the program of Alcoholics Anonymous a fair shake. And I got a sponsor. A man of my stature had to do the steps again. Okay, I had to wake up every morning and pray that God removed everything I thought I knew of Alcoholics Anonymous, everything I thought I knew about life and about you people, so that he could open me up for new experiences so that I could become teachable again. Okay, I had to go to 3-4 meetings a day. I couldn't drive anywhere. I called my car Trigger. Trigger would want to go this way, and I knew I had to go this way, so I would get rides. Okay, yeah, okay. I had to become involved in alcohol and H&I again and do all these things and become sponsored. My grand sponsor is Clancy. My sponsor is Ted Summers, okay, who talks a lot about the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous, that laughter is the language of the heart and that we're not a glum lot. And he talks a lot about page 132, okay, that why shouldn't we laugh, okay? We have recovered and been given the power to help others. Okay, outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over seemingly tragic experiences out of our past. Why shouldn't we laugh? Okay, you know, and I started learning some of these fundamental truths about Alcoholics Anonymous and about God. See, all my life I was looking for God out there, and God was in here. You know, and it talks about that deep down in every one of us is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by the calamity, the pomp, the worship of other things, but it's there, and it's only there that he may be found. I love it when it says in the final analysis, it talks about the great reality being deep down in us, and in the final analysis it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Well, it was so with me. It talks about stepping from that bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. Okay? And all these fundamental truths I just started believing and incorporating because it was all part of the journey. Now let me tell you that relapse is not a requirement, okay, for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way the program works, okay, is you're supposed to come in and get sober and stay sober. And there's a lot of people in this room right here that have done just that. And that's how the program's supposed to work. You know, in the foreword of the second edition, it talks about how 50% of us that came here got sober and stayed sober. 25% after some relapses stayed sober. That's a 75% success rate right there. 25 showed marked improvement by just being around us, okay? You know, and I had to start reading and believing these things and practicing these principles in all my affairs, that rigorous self-honesty, okay, and that it was God, okay? See, I remember when I took my 30-day chip several years ago again, and I was walking up to the podium, and I was going to tell you all the things that I had done, all the meetings I was going to, all the things that I had accomplished. And I started walking up there, and I started crying, because I realized that I couldn't get 30 days. I had to have God's help. I had to. I couldn't do it. And it was those spiritual truths that have kept me coming back. And I've had a wonderful experience in Alcoholics Anonymous these last 6 years. You know, I've traveled all over the country and had commitments and got involved. You know, I heard a lot of people talk about this isn't a program for people that need it. It's for people that want it. My experience is, though, that's not the case. Because I wanted it, and I couldn't get it. And my experience is it's not for people that need it, and it's not for people that want it. It's for people that do it. See, I had to do it. This is the program of action. I had to get off my butt, and I had to take commitments, and I had to be a greeter, and I had to pick up coffee cups and ashtrays. I had to do these things to be part of, because all my life I was apart from. I was better than you or less than you. And I would come into these rooms and I would sit on this throne of judgment, and I would judge you because you're a hypocrite and you're screwing this girl and you're doing this and you're cheating on your wife and all this other stuff. Oh my God, he's got to share again. God, can he come up with anything different this time? I got to listen to this. I would think of all these things and stuff, and I judge myself right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I don't do that today. I don't do that today. You know, Dr. Bob talked about that love and charity, and I love it when they talk about the four absolutes, because I believe, in my own experience, is they're just as prevalent today as they were back with the Oxford Group when we first started meeting as the drunk squad of the Oxford Group. And they basically had the yardstick of the honesty, the unselfishness, the love, and the purity. And if I could put each questionable situation to the test, see, I as a man do not always know what the right thing to do is. I really don't. But I know what the wrong thing to do is. Okay? I know what the wrong thing to do is. And if I can practice on not doing the wrong thing, usually the right thing happens. And those are the yardsticks that I try to live by today, too. You know, that absolute honesty, that rigorous self-honesty, the humility. Don just gave me a thing of humility that used to sit on Dr. Bob's desk. And when Dr. Bob would talk about this humility, he was talking in the sense towards our Heavenly Father. See, I've been dipped and sprinkled and baptized and you name it. No, I really have. I'm Catholic, Irish Catholic, Episcopalian, born-again Christian. I took the lessons for Mormonism and got baptized as a Mormon. I've read the Quran, Shalom Aleichem. I've done this, I've done that. Oh, no! Because you never know, okay? Okay? I want to cover all bases, okay? You know, but this when Reverend Shoemaker and Father Ed used to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and how we got this program from the 13th chapter of Corinthians and the book of James and the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew and the varieties of religious experience, and we got our foundation from the church, okay? And that from getting our foundation from the church, that maybe now it's time that we can give back to the church, okay? And that the church can take from us, okay? And that they used to talk about it as a partnership, and that spiritual seeking to find this God. We don't have a monopoly on how to get sober. We really don't. I've heard people say that AA is a cult and all this, and you know what? If that's your definition of a cult, then it's a cult. It's the good things. It's the positive things. You know, it's an absolutely beautiful program of people helping people that are weak, that we get to help each other to stand on our own, and then we get to stand on our own, we get to keep it by giving it away and becoming a part of. You know, I believe that God has called each and every one of us, I don't care whether you're a man or woman, I think he's called each and every one of us to be a certain type of person. You know, in all my life I was denying that, Today I don't deny it. Today I go where God asked me to go. I say what God asked me to say, and you know what? I speak from the heart. When you speak from the heart listens. And that's what I was taught. And I show respect for the people that have gone before me. I absolutely love old-timers. And I love coming in and sitting down and listening to the stories of old-timers. See, it hasn't always been like that. And we see people today that come in, they want to change things, you know, because they know a little better way or an easier, softer way. See, I know I'm the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know a lot of you are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, and it's up to me with that dignity and respect that I display towards our elders is to learn from them, to keep this tradition, because our common welfare has to come first. Has to come first. For these doors to be open when the real alcoholic shows up and wants to find a better way. I have to learn from them. It reminds me of a story of this farmer. You know, he needed a new rooster because his rooster was getting old. And he went out and he got one of those Rhode Island Reds, you know, with the long red beak. And he got this Rhode Island Red, and he took the Rhode Island Red home and he put it out in the barn. And this young rooster comes walking in and he starts taking over and herding all the chicks over into one side of the barn. And here's this old rooster just looking at him doing all this. And the old rooster went up to him and said, hey, you know, he goes, I know why you're here. He goes, I know you're going to take over one day. He goes, but why don't you let me show you how the farm works? You know, let me show you all the ins and outs and what you need to do and look out for and stuff. And the young rooster said, no, I know what I'm doing. And walked away from him and herded them all in the corner. So the old rooster thought about it a little while. A couple days went by, went back up to him and said, hey, you know what? Why don't you let me show you? Show me the dignity and the respect I deserve. I've been doing this for a long time. I can help you to do this. And the young rooster wouldn't hear anything about it because he knew better. So the old rooster went back in the corner and stopped for a couple of days and went back up to the new rooster. He says, okay, listen. He goes, you're not showing me any respect. Dignity, I've been doing this a long time. I want you to do something for me. The young rooster said, yeah, what's that? He goes, I want you to chase me. I want you to catch me and kick the shit out of me. Young rooster looked at him. He goes, no, that's what I want you to throw me out of this barn so that at least I can walk out with my head held high. But don't come in here like you're going to take over and just, you know, disrespect me like this. The young rooster goes, okay, I can do that. So they go on opposite ends of the barns. And all of a sudden that old rooster, he yells. And that young rooster starts chasing him around the barn. Well, just then the farmer hears something in the barn. He thinks that there's a fox in his chicken coop there. And he grabs his shotgun. He goes running out the door. He whips open the door. And here's this young rooster chasing the old rooster around the barn. He takes the shotgun. Boom! He kills that young rooster. Well, just then his wife comes walking up and goes, what happened? He goes, it's the damnedest thing. That's the fourth square rooster we've gotten in the last month. See, the moral of the story is you got to watch out for those old-timers, okay? They got a few tricks up their sleeves, and they've been doing this thing for a long time, and we as the newer members need to show the dignity and the respect that they deserve, okay, and learn from them, because that's what this is a process of, okay? It's a process of. You know, I'll share two quick experiences with you, and, we were talking about the Vatican last night for some reason. I was over there on my fifth anniversary, and I got asked to speak at St. Paul's Cathedral, and what an honor that was. These are some of the blessings that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous to be a part of one more time. You know, when I got sober this time, it was never with the thought of I'm going to have the opportunity to get up here. It was never with the thought of that I'm going to get my wife back or my kids back or my businesses back. Okay, it was never those things. It was just the process of I didn't want to drink anymore. And I wanted that absolute surrender came the absolute release of the obsession. And it is there that I found my God. Okay. And I just wanted to be sober, and I wanted to help other people. And consequently, He has blessed me, you know. And He has blessed you if you're sitting here and you're sober. Even if you're not sober, He's blessed you, okay? He's blessed you. But, you know, I travel a lot, and I got those businesses back, and I'm in the restaurant business. I own several restaurants, and, you know, as I started early, I am a millionaire. I don't say that stuff to impress you. I really don't, but to impress upon you the seriousness of this disease and how we, you too, we, I can become whatever I'm capable of becoming, as long as it's legal, I don't hurt God, God's kids, I don't step on them, okay? I'm honest, I'm open, I'm willing to do and go where He wants me to go. And a year and a half ago, I took a trip. All the things that you hear as a kid, we're going to buy a motorhome, we're going to travel the country, we're going to do this. I had been saying that for years. My dad said that for years. Well, I did that, and I took a seven and a half week trip, 12,000-mile trip, out of the country twice. One of the last ones on the way back was Akron, Ohio, you know, and I'll talk about that in a second because it was a wonderful experience. But one of the most memorable meetings that I went to was in Fredericksburg. Now, Fredericksburg, see, these miracles that happen, you need to go to meetings to hear them, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? And I was at this meeting, and this woman, she was 85 years old, and she was having a 30-year anniversary, and she was a white woman. And she talked about what it was like as a white girl growing up in the South. And on their block, they had a mammy, a big black woman, that they would go to and sit on mammy's lap. Okay? And she was 5 years old, and she remembered sitting on mammy's lap, and she was rubbing mammy's arm. Okay? And she looked down at mammy, and mammy looked at her and said, "Child, child, my skin is as dark as the night, but my soul is as white as snow, just like yours." 50 years later, in this grips of this disease of alcoholism, she couldn't stop drinking. And in that moment of surrender, she looked down at her skin, and she remembered Mammy. And she said, my God, my skin is as snow as white as snow, but my soul is as dark as the night." She said, "Help me." See, and God doesn't make too hard of terms on us, as long as we're honest and willing enough to try. It says in our book that it doesn't matter your race, your creed, your color, that each and every one of us is able to build this relationship with a loving God as long as we are honest and willing enough to try. And that's what I did. That's my story. I became honest and willing enough to try. You know, I came to Akron, Ohio, and I went to the inner group, and I went to Dr. Bob's house and the archives and King School and St. Thomas, Sister Ignatius Ward, and went to a meeting there and learned a little bit more of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to this meeting called the Kenmore Group, and some of you may have been to the Kenmore Group, and this guy had started it with Bill Dodson, AA number 3. And he had 50-something years sobriety, and I go in, and him and I are talking. And I had, you know, 4.5 years at the time, and we're talking, and he looked at me and he says, How long you been in the program? And I said, "Well, a little over 4 years now." He goes, No. "How long you been in AA?" I said, "Well, a little over 30. And he started laughing, right? He started laughing at me. He goes, "Well, what'd you learn?" So I start telling him what I learned about ego and pride and arrogance. He laughed all the harder. And he says, "No, kid." He goes, "You learn not to take the first drink." And I said, "Okay, I get it," right? He goes, "Come here." And we walked over to a table. It was a round table. And this older gentleman was sitting there. He's 75 years old. And he introduces me to him, and he goes, "He's got 18 months. And I said, "Wow." Right? So I start telling this guy, you know, Mr. AA, you know, I start telling this guy, "It doesn't matter how old you are, this program will work for you." And he starts laughing at me. He goes, "Kid," he goes, "I had 25 years sobriety." He goes, "And when I turned 70, he goes, "I figured I didn't need you people anymore, so I stopped coming to meetings." He goes, "And I drank, and it took me almost 5 years to make it back here." And I thought, wow. Now the old guy that's standing next to me, he starts elbowing me. "Ask him what he learned, ask him what he learned," right? So I said, "Okay, can I ask you what you learned?" He goes, "I learned not to take the first drink." I said, "Okay. People can't hear until they can hear, and they can't see until they can see. And I've heard things thousands of times, but I heard, and I saw, and I felt. And that's what I learned, is not to take the first drink." The guy went on to tell me, he says, "You know, I believe had I not stopped coming to meetings, I would have never drank." He looked at me, and he goes, "I bet you stopped coming to meetings." And I said, "No, sir." I said, "I came to meetings right up to the night I drank." And he looked at me a little puzzled, and he says, "Well, why did you drink?" And I said, "Well, I was just really dishonest." See, we can go out for a lot of reasons. We can go out for a lot of reasons. You know, and I'm here because I don't want to drink anymore. I'm on another journey now, and my wife and I, we had just still have the restaurants in California, but we bought a piece of property upstate New York, just north of Utica, just moved last month. Got a beautiful spread, 75 acres, old farmhouse, outbuildings, everything. We're We're in a two-year process where we got a plan where we're going to put some cabins along the river. We've got river, waterfalls, beaver, mink, deer, otter, you name it, it's all there. And we're going to try to hold an annual retreat there for men, a men's retreat, a women's retreat, and a couple's retreat to try to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what has so freely been given me. And that's my life. You know, that's my life. You know, I'll leave you with this because I can literally talk for hours about Alcoholics Anonymous. I can literally talk for hours and the history, you know. I got told a long time ago that I needed to take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and cut a suit out that was going to fit me. Because your suit might get me drunk, okay? You know, and I remember years and years ago sitting in prison and this guy, Bill Sharp, an old-timer, he came up. And you're not allowed to have money in prison back then. And he came up and he reached into his pocket, right? And he goes like this. This is a $20 bill. He goes, does anybody know what this is? So I'll ask you, does anybody know what this is? Yeah? Does anybody want it?
Yeah.
Anybody want it? Yeah? Here? Here? Does anybody want it? Come on. Oh! There you go. No, no. That's yours. That's yours. That's yours. You're welcome. Now, see, I was sitting there when this guy did this, and I thought, what the hell is he doing? See, what does money have to do with AA? You know, you went on to tell the analogy that it's like AA. See, we all knew what that was. I can't think of a person that didn't really want it or need it. But see, he had to get off his ass and come up here and get it. Okay? I wasn't going to give it to him. And this is a program for action for the people that do it. Okay? We all see the 12 steps. We see the light in people's eyes. We see the big book. We see the changes of the human condition. Okay? And we want it and we need it. But the action is we have to do it. I will leave you with this, that when you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to a mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict that counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up till the end. And you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. Some people may call you a straight-shooting chum and call you a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of life and get pats on your back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartaches and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. You see, I cheated myself for a long time, both in and out of these rooms. I didn't like my booze watered down. What do I want the program of Alcoholics Anonymous watered down and cut for? This is the real deal. And if you're an alcoholic, we have a common solution that we can absolutely agree upon. And I would like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.